Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In Kingman, Arizona, in the spring of 1953, is potentially one of the most controversial UFO crash cases in history. In most of these cases, despite the obvious caution, such claims usually fall into one category or another. With the Kingman event, compelling arguments are made for both it being a genuine event or something explained with more down-to-earth reasons. The Kingman UFO crash has been debated for decades, and as things stand right now, looks set to continue to be so for decades to come. Even though the events occurred 75 years ago, in the first years of the modern UFO era. This is the story of the Kingman UFO crash.
This is Somewhere in the Skies with Ryan Spread.
According to a chapter written in the book Exposed, Uncovered, and Declassified by author and researcher Nick Redfern, the origins of the apparent UFO crash at Kingman, Arizona can be traced back to 1971. Redfern relays that two young UFO investigators, Jeff Young and Paul Chetham, were investigating reports of the alleged crash, which included not only the recovery of the craft, but an extraterrestrial body as well. Redfern would relate that the pair obtained much of their information via a friend of the Young family, Arthur Stansel, who further claimed that he himself had firsthand knowledge of the incident. Stansel, for the most part, and at least on the surface, appeared to be credible and reliable. He was a veteran of the Second World War, who had taken part in the D-Day landings, and had since obtained a master's degree in engineering. But of more interest to the investigators, at the time of the incident in early 1953, Stansel was walking at the, quote, ultra-secret Nevada Proving Ground, where many atomic bombs were being tested, particularly between the spring and summer of that year, as part of Operation Upshot Knothole. On the evening of May 21st, 1953, Stansel would be witness to something a little different from nuclear weapons tests. And even more interesting, the incident, according to Stansel, was investigated by none other than the U.S. Air Force's Project Blue Book. But even more interesting, Stansel was indeed working for Project Blue Book at the time. On the night in question, the base commander at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio made an out-of-the-blue phone call to Stansel. He would order him to make his way to Phoenix, Arizona, where he would be picked up by a waiting military vehicle and taken to the location of a recently crashed vehicle several miles outside Kingman. A vehicle, he was told, was a top-secret military project. When he arrived there, however, he felt the downed craft, or what was left of it, was not of any design he had ever previously seen. He recalled that it was a cross between a teardrop and a cigar, and was approximately 12 feet long. Further details were offered years later, in 2016, by another UFO investigator and past contributing writer for the podcast, Preston Dennett, who claimed that the object was metallic, 30 feet wide, and 3.5 feet high, as well as being oval-shaped with portholes. More astonishing, inside the crippled object were the remains of a humanoid occupant, although they were certainly not human. According to Stancil, this humanoid figure was around 4 feet tall, with dark skin and facial features that were unlike any human being. Once again, we should highlight the comments of the previously mentioned Preston Dennett, who claimed there were, quote, 2 to 4 4-foot-tall humanoids inside the craft, all of which were dead and wore metallic suits and had large, dark eyes. From there, as Redfern further relays in his book, the investigation grew cold. An article did appear, though, in the April 23, 1973 edition of the Middlesex News, an article that caught the attention of UFO investigator Raymond Fowler. Intrigued by the claims, Fowler himself began investigating the alleged crash. In a bizarre twist, Fowler would eventually discover that Stancil was employed by the same company he himself had worked for, and contacting him was decidedly simple. On the afternoon of May 4th, 1973, almost 20 years to the day that the apparent incident occurred, Fowler walked into Stancil's office in order to speak to the witness further of what he knew of the controversial claims of downed alien craft and extraterrestrial occupants. And it was here where the tale began to take a series of twists. Stancil began to tell his account to Fowler. However, it was immediately apparent that there were several distinct differences between this version of events and the one he had recalled to Young and Chatham. Fowler confronted Stancil with this, to which he responded that he was simply the worse for several martinis at the time he had first told of the incident. Still, at least a little suspicious, Fowler continued with his investigation, based very much on the details that Stancil had offered. Stancil had stated to Fowler that upon arriving in Phoenix that May afternoon, he was placed on a bus with blacked-out windows and driven to the location in question. As opposed to what he had told the two young UFO investigators in 1971, this version of events now matched one that was put forward by Preston Dennett. Stancil elaborated that when the investigative team looked inside the object, they could see a cabin that was oval-shaped and contained several technical screens and advanced devices, as well as two swivel-type chairs. Despite being told that the vehicle was a top-secret military craft, he stressed that everything about it was unlike anything he'd ever seen before, and he had sincere doubts that the object was made on Earth. According to the research of Preston Dennett, the craft and the occupant was quickly moved to a discreet military facility, either Area 51 in Nevada or to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. Further studies of the craft, according to the information volunteered by Stancil, the craft likely struck the ground at around 1,200 miles per hour. Despite this, though, it was only damaged in a very minor way. Fowler would discover that Stancil had indeed worked in a variety of positions at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base between 1949 and 1960. And again, many of these departments and programs would have indeed dealt with recovered military vehicles, at least officially. Despite the discrepancies and the admittance of having been drinking at one point while relaying all this, Fowler did believe Stancil to be a credible witness, and when other witnesses began to approach Fowler over the coming years with their accounts, that Stancil's overall version of events appeared to be corroborated. Several years later, beginning in the late 1970s, UFO researcher and investigator Leonard Stringfield began writing and speaking of the case. The first of these was at the annual Mutual UFO Network Symposium in 1978. At the symposium, Stringfield told of an account that he had been told by a fellow UFO researcher, Charles Wilhelm, who had in turn been told of the account from his father that involved a one Major Daly, who claimed that he had been taken to the site of a UFO crash sometime around April 1953, only a month out from the date offered by Stanzel of May 1953. Further resonating with Stanzel's account, the location was somewhere in the desert, and Daly had arrived there after being placed on a bus and blindfolded. Daly would describe the downed craft as being largely undamaged, of a metallic material, and around 30 feet across. Leonard Stringfield would reveal further details of his investigation into the account 2 years later in 1980. According to his account, during the summer of 1977, he was approached by a pilot following a UFO lecture in Cincinnati, Ohio. The pilot claimed that he had been present at a UFO crash site in Arizona at some point in early 1953, a site somewhere in the desert. What's more, there were several alien bodies recovered from the craft and taken to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. The description of these alien bodies was remarkably similar to what was offered by Stanzel, in that they were humanoid, but with distinct differences, not least the large eyes and the fact that they were only around 4 feet tall. This anonymous pilot further offered that one of these aliens was actually alive when the team arrived, but that it had died shortly after. Stringfield, now more convinced than ever of the possibility of this account, at least the basic details of it, would continue investigating it and taking in new information as the years went by, and by the mid-1990s had further information to reveal. It was in February 1994 when Stringfield next revealed new significant information regarding the alleged UFO crash at Kingman. According to Stringfield, a source he identified only as, quote, JLD, had approached him. What's more, he had knowledge of not just one UFO crash in Arizona in 1953, but two of them. However, in a further disappointing twist, Stringfield died a short time later. The identity of JLD remained a complete mystery. Several years later, though, another UFO investigator would step forward with apparent new information. Following the death of Stringfield, UFO investigator Don Schmidt would come forward following information he had received on the alleged UFO crash at Kingman from a woman by the name of Judy Woolcott. According to what she told Schmidt, in 1965, she received a letter from her husband, who at the time was serving in Vietnam, and to say that the letter concerned her would be an understatement. In the letter, her husband told her of a bizarre event he had witnessed 12 years previously, in 1953. The location of this apparent event? Kingman, Arizona. Judy would state that her husband, who was a military officer at the time, and who also happened to be on duty on the night in question, claimed that an unidentified object had been picked up by the military radar. It had appeared out of nowhere and appeared to be losing altitude at a rapid rate. Then, it simply disappeared from the screen. According to her husband, something otherworldly had crashed somewhere in the desert near Kingman. And even more intriguing, several alien occupants had been recovered from the wreckage. Even more concerning to Judy, though, was the intense feeling that her husband wouldn't make it home from Vietnam alive. Whether it was connected to the information he had relayed to his wife in the letter, Judy confirmed that her husband did indeed die in Vietnam. The story, though, would take on further twists and turns into the opening decades of the 21st century, over half a century after the alleged UFO came crashing to the ground in May of 1953. Judy's claims stood for around a decade. However, in 2010, researcher Kevin Randall re-examined the case, including the testimony of one Judy Woolcott, who, unfortunately at the time, had passed away. Ultimately, Randall found ample evidence to treat Judy's version of events with suspicion, to say the very least. As relayed by Nick Redfern, in his previous book, Randall would discover that much, if not all, of Judy's version of events simply didn't add up. According to Randall's research, Judy's husband had not died while serving in Vietnam. And perhaps more damaging, her own daughter offered to Randall that her mother often lied and made up stories regarding events in her life. In the age of the internet and instant access to information, debates still raged over just how credible the account of the Kingman UFO crash was, even if such accounts as those from Stancil and Judy went off the mark. Might it be that the basic notion of a downed UFO in the Arizona desert at some time in 1953 be more credible than most people thought? We might keep in mind that the alleged crash occurred in between particularly heavy UFO waves across the United States, in 1952 and 1954 respectively. So we know that whatever that might have been, there was a prolonged and persistent UFO presence over the United States during this time. Unfortunately, along with Judy Wolcott, Stancil has also since passed away in 2006. However, another person came forward with a story of their own. The Somewhere in the Skies podcast is free to listen to every week, but if you would like to help support the show, we have a very active Patreon page where you give what you think the show is worth. In return, you'll get early access to the main show, bonus episodes, and priority to ask our guests your listener questions. Your support truly makes the show continue and grow. So, to learn more and to join, visit patreon.com/somewhereskies. In his book, Nick Redfern also highlights several developments regarding the Kingman crash.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
For example, another apparent whistleblower surfaced, one Bill Uhouse, who claimed to have worked on several top-secret government projects in Nevada decades prior. One of these locations, Uhouse claimed, was none other than Area 51. As well as possibly working with what he claimed was alien technology from downed vehicles, Uhouse also claimed that several alien entities, referred to as EBEs, or extraterrestrial biological entities, were also housed at this top-secret location. Even more remarkable, some of these aliens were alive. Perhaps of further interest was the assertion that the reason the public is kept in the dark regarding ETs and alien technology goes back to a deal organized by President Eisenhower. Uhouse would elaborate before his death in 2009 that a, quote, peace pact of sorts was signed, something arranged between Eisenhower on behalf of the United States, the United Nations, and the extraterrestrial race concerned. Of course, this would resonate nicely with the assertions that Eisenhower had made a deal with an extraterrestrial race in February 1954, less than a year after the alleged Kingman crash, for advanced technology in return for a base to work out of in America, as well as access to the population for experimental purposes, essentially permission to abduct people. Perhaps of more interest, though, are the claims from Uhouse that one of those projects was the UFO that had crashed just outside of Kingman in 1953. And he would state, the same as Stansel, that four extraterrestrial occupants were recovered from the wreckage, one of whom initially survived but died a short time later. There was one other particular point of interest that Uhouse offered that could have been corroborated by the release of information that appeared online from an anonymous whistleblower who claimed he used to work for United States intelligence. Uhouse had offered that several of the recovery team at the Kingman incident had gone on to develop a multitude of health problems that appeared to have been from coming into contact with either the wrecked craft, the ETs, or both. According to what this anonymous source stated, the Kingman UFO crash was an actual event, and it was one that did indeed result in the recovery of four alien occupants. The alleged former intelligence officer, however, claimed that of the four, two of the ETs survived the crash. Perhaps the crucial detail, though, is the assertion that several of the recovery team went on to experience ill health. And this was due, in fact, to coming into close contact with the wreckage. As we can imagine, there have been several different reactions from inside the UFO community from this testimony. While some believe it offers further proof to the fact that an alien vessel did indeed come crashing on the ground, others believe it's merely another false statement with little evidence to back it up. While it is certainly possible that the anonymous intelligence officer is a credible source, after all, if one was to divulge such secrets, they would surely do so under anonymity, for obvious reasons. We can suspect that if someone was looking to manufacture such an account, they would not do so anonymously. What would be the point? On most occasions, those who submit false reports do so for attention or the possibility of monetary reward, something they could not get while remaining unknown. But there is, of course, a third possibility. The government or intelligence agencies purposefully planted this information into the UFO community as disinformation at its finest, a way of making the waters much murkier than they already are, and possibly to be able to dismiss other testimonies as false all that easier. We've seen this before in the UFO field many times, where one truth is sandwiched between two lies. The sandwich always spoils and is thrown out entirely. Let's stay with Redfern's summary of the case a little further, as he highlights the claims of one Marion Shaw in 2009, who came forward with apparent further corroborating testimony regarding the Kingman UFO crash. She claimed that she had worked as a secretary in the early 1950s at the Pentagon. She had worked her way up to working with high security documents. She claimed that she had once been asked to type a report on the apparent Kingman UFO crash, a lengthy document at that, and that this report mentioned the recovery of both the craft and extraterrestrials. She would elaborate that the report featured details of the craft and why it was thought to have crashed, as well as autopsies on the dead alien bodies. Despite these claims, there could indeed be a more rational explanation. Indeed, Nick Redfern summarized by offering such an explanation, that the downed craft was in fact a QF-80 aircraft. that was remotely piloted and featured a chimpanzee in the cockpit as part of the tests relating to the nuclear weapons at the time. Specifically, how the planes and pilots would fare if they had to fly into an atomic cloud. Is it possible that one of these planes could have crash-landed in Kingman, Arizona? And if we assume the wings were lost, the fuselage, as Redfern points out, would appear very much like a cigar-shaped object. As for the apparent alien, it is perhaps reasonable to think, given this animal pilot was wearing basic pilot equipment, including a helmet, that these pilots, who would only have been seen fleetingly and from a distance, would mistake them for alien entities. Furthermore, if we assume these tests did involve the flying through atomic clouds, then that might explain why some of the recovery team felt unwell in the days that followed. In short, something did happen that day. But it was, as Stanzo claimed, an accident with a top-secret military aircraft involving tests the military, in the Cold War environment no less, wished to keep as close to the chest as possible. As we might imagine, many people maintain that Kingman has more to it than we currently recognize. With all of this in mind, just what should we make of the allegations that a UFO, or a vehicle from another world, piloted by extraterrestrial occupants, crash-landed in the desert of Arizona? As we've seen from Redfern's compelling argument, it does make sense. And given everything we know of the claims surrounding the apparent crash, this conclusion is arguably the most likely. But we can't fully discount the idea of alien craft crashing to the ground during the 1940s and 50s. Is it really that much of a stretch of the imagination? Especially when we consider the sheer wealth of claims that have come from whistleblowers, albeit many of whom remain anonymous, not to mention possible crash retrieval programs throughout the years. And while we should, by their nature, treat these claims with just a pinch of salt, there are enough of them to continue to keep poking away at these claims. After all, if only one of them is even partially true, it changes things for all of us. And maybe it's possible that one case happened in Kingman, Arizona in 1953. Here, in an exclusive interview with the Disclosure Project, Bill Uhouse talks about working on re-engineered ET craft, particularly the one that crashed in Kingman, Arizona.
I've spent 10 years in Marine Corps, 4 years working with the Air Force as a civilian, doing experimental testing on aircraft. Since my Marine Corps days, I was a pilot in the service and a fighter pilot, and fought in World War II the latter part of World War II and the Korean War conflict. After I got out of the Marine Corps, I took a job with the Air Force at Wright-Patterson doing experimental flight testing on various different modifications and tech orders that they had incorporated into aircraft, various different aircraft, F-89, back then the B-47, F-102, and those aircraft. While I was at Wright-Patterson, of course, I was approached by an individual that, and I'm not going to mention his name, to determine if I wanted to work in an area on just new creative things, okay, and apparently that was the flying disc simulator. What they had done, they had selected several of us, and they reassigned me to a Link Aviation, which was a simulator manufacturer. At that time, they were building what they call the C-11B and F-102 simulator, B-47 simulator, and so forth. And they wanted us to get the experience before we actually started work on the flying disc simulator, which I spent 30-some years working on. The simulator wasn't actually functional until around 1958, where the simulator was actually operable. The simulator that they used, or the craft that they used to build, which is a 30-meter one, was the one that they crashed in Arizona, Kingman, Arizona, back in 53 or 52. I think it was 53. That's the one they used. That's the first one that they took out to the test site. It was a controlled craft, you know, that the aliens wanted to present to our government, or the USA. It landed about 15 miles from which used to be an Army air base, which is now a defunct Army base. I can't recall the name of it. But that particular craft, there were some problems with, number one, getting it on the flatbed to take it up to Area 51. They couldn't get it across the dam because of the road. It had to be barged across the Colorado River at the time, and then taken up to where people go now, up 93, out to Area 51, which was just being really constructed at the time, and taken down those dirt roads and out to that particular area of the test site. There were four aliens aboard that thing, and those aliens went to Los Alamos. It was a sort of a test thing. They set up Los Alamos with a particular area for those guys, and they put certain people in there with them, people that were astrophysicists, just general scientists, to ask them questions. The way the story was told to me was there was only one of them that would talk to any of these scientists that they put in the lab with them. Only one of the aliens. The rest wouldn't talk to anybody or, even have a conversation with them. First they thought, it was all, ESP or, mental telepathy. But, most of that is kind of a joke to me because they actually speak, maybe not like we do, but they actually speak and can converse, But there was only one. The difference between this aircraft or this disc and other discs that they had looked at was that it was much simpler design. In the simulator, it was one big thing different. The thing that, like Lazar calls the reactor, okay, we didn't have a reactor. We had a space and a thing that looked like the reactor, but that wasn't the thing we operated the simulator with. We operated with six large capacitors that were charged with a million volts each. Say there were 6 million volts in those capacitors. They're largest capacitors ever built. These particular capacitors, they last for 30 minutes, so you could get in there and actually work the controls and do what you had to get the aircraft or get the simulator, the disc to operate, okay? Actually, when it was operable, it would lift off the ball about a certain amount of there was a dimension there that we had that it actually lifted up, and it could actually turn a certain amount of degrees left to right or whatever. But in a simulator now, you'll notice that there are no seat belts, right? And the same thing with the actual craft, no seat belts. You don't need seat belts because when you fly one of these things upside down, there's no upside down like in a regular aircraft. You have your own gravitational field right inside. So if you're flying upside down, to you, you're right side up. There weren't any windows. The only place we had any visibility at all, and it was done with with cameras or video type things at that time, was in the turret section. My thing was the flight deck, and the instruments on the flight deck. I knew about the gravitational field and what it took to get people to, train them to be able to come in that thing, and operate. You would be sick or disoriented in about 2 minutes after getting in, after it was cranked up. After a while, after you get used to it and all, and you do it, it's simple. You just you got to know where everything is, you know, and you got to understand what's going to happen to your body. It's no different than, you know, accepting the G-forces, you know, when you're flying an aircraft or coming out of a dive, you know, and that kind of thing. It's a whole new ballgame. Each engineer that had anything to do with the design was part of startup crew. You know, verify all their stuff that they put in works like it's supposed to. So you really never knew how many we had. The last 40 years or so, or 60 years, maybe there's, I'd say 40 years anyway, not counting the simulators, I'm talking about actual craft, there's probably 2 or 3 dozen. There are certain reasons for the secrecy. I could understand that, no different than, you know, the first atomic bomb that they built. But, you know, they're getting so far ahead now with aircraft design, and people have come up and they're visualizing and seeing some of the design aspects that are put in some of the aircraft today. And eventually, I'm saying most of this stuff will be out in everybody's plate to look at. Maybe not the way that everybody expects it, but in some manner they determine appropriate, you know, to show everybody, hey, look at what we got.
This episode was researched and written by Marcus Loth. To learn more, visit UFOinsight.com. If you have a moment, please follow, subscribe, rate, and review Somewhere in the Skies on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. It helps us gain visibility and find new listeners. We're on Twitter at Somewhere Skies and Instagram at Somewhere Skies Pod. If you'd like to share your personal UFO story on the show, reach out to us on social media, or an email can be found in our link tree on social media. If you'd like to help support the show, we now offer all the same benefits as Patreon directly on Apple. Just go to the top of your Somewhere in the Skies Apple feed and become an Apple Premium subscriber today. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, keep your feet on the ground, but never stop searching Somewhere in the Skies.
Somewhere in the Skies is produced by Third Kind Productions in association with the Entertainment One Podcast Network.
Hey guys, Ryan here, and I've got some exciting news. We've recently partnered with Alien Coffee Bean to bring you the official Somewhere in the Skies coffee. That's right. What better way to listen to the show than with a delicious cup of Somewhere in the Skies? It's a perfect dark roast for those who love an earthly, full-bodied smoothness. These delicious beans come from the island of Sumatra in Indonesia. We've worked very closely with Alien Coffee Bean to make sure this roast was exactly what we wanted it to be. So I hope you enjoy, and I hope you'll pick up a bag of Somewhere in the Skies coffee today. Now available within the United States, with plans to go international in the very near future. Head on over to aliencoffeebean.com and use the promo code SOMEWHERESKIES10 to get 10% off your order. Again, that's aliencoffeebean.com. Remember, keep your feet on the ground, but never stop drinking Somewhere in the Skies.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.